4. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he may take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days." When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for such a time as this." Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So let's think about all the elements that make up a really good story. What characters would you have? If you're Disney, if we think about this like Disney would think about it, you're probably thinking of a young and beautiful heroine who was orphaned at a young age, was raised by a parental figure, and goes on a long journey of self-discovery. You might have a bungling ruler who seems as if they may be the villain unwittingly or because of carelessness or recklessness, but they're really being puppeted by the true evil character who is fueled by pure hatred. Maybe hatred of a person or of an entire community. This villain creates a dire situation in which the heroine is presented with a choice. Will she do something or will she do nothing? The heroine often goes through intense transformation, and the villain always ends up getting their just desserts. All of these elements create an interesting story, and it always presents a moral fact of life neatly wrapped up in a bow. I imagine as I describe that kind of plot, you may have thought of a movie or two that fit the script. Maybe Aladdin came to mind, or parts of Tangled. But as you may have suspected, I'm not thinking about a modern movie or book. I'm thinking about an ancient book that holds a story of this very same nature, Esther. But beneath the simple and flat surface of Esther lurks very mature themes. Racism, life under the Persian Empire, the threat of genocide, and an all too powerful and incompetent ruler. This story is layered and may just have something for us today in our time. This novella-like story was probably first written as an explanation of the Jewish festival of Purim, as this festival isn't described anywhere else in the Bible. It was likely adapted from the Persian community while the Jews were living in exile, and made into something of their own by that Jewish community, But a story in which the Jewish population in Susa narrowly avoided total annihilation is probably much easier to remember and more interesting to tell. In the past, this book has been read as a historical text, but it is clearly a fictional story with flat characters and boxes of good and bad. In this way, Esther is meant to be read as a fictional story that deals with real and present themes that they were experiencing at the time of its composition, for Jews living under exile in the Persian Empire. At the beginning of the book, King Xerxes I of Persia is looking for a new, young virgin bride, because his wife, Queen Vashti, has been banished from the court because she refused to appear before the king when summoned to dance naked in front of him and all of his drunken friends at one of his parties. And because of her choice, this opinionated and self-respecting queen is deposed by the king in order to restore his honor after such an embarrassment and paves the way for Esther's introduction into the story. Esther is likely chosen in part because she was beautiful, and in part because of all the ways she was different than Queen Vashti. Vashti was opinionated and willing to lose everything if it meant she did not stoop to the level of the king. And it did end up costing her everything. Esther, on the other hand, was a passive and obedient woman. She was raised by her cousin Mordecai, and even after her marriage to the king, when she became the queen of Persia, she continued to obey Mordecai when he told her to hide the fact that she was a Jew. And I'm certain her disposition did not go unaccounted for when the king was making his choice. And after Esther had already been queen for around 5 years, Haman, the king's right-hand man and the true villain of this story, does not feel he's getting the respect he deserves from Mordecai. So he swears he'll do everything in his power to destroy Mordecai and his people, which he doesn't know at this point includes Esther. At the end of chapter 3, Haman has successfully executed his plan to convince the king to sign an edict to destroy the Jews, and they've already displayed this ordinance in the heart of the city. This chapter ends with the epitome of power and with the drawing of your attention to a boundary. At the end of chapter 3, there are self-absorbed leaders. The king and Haman sit together, they drink, and they're totally unaware of the massive shock and trauma that they've left with the Jewish people. And that boundary could not be more unabashedly unambiguous between that chapter 3 with the power in the palace and the oppressed Jewish people at the beginning of chapter 4. Chapter 4 begins with the response Mordecai has to this edict. He's learned of everything Haman has done, most likely through a bit of palace gossip between eunuchs, handmaids, and other employees of the royal court, and immediately engages in a public display of mourning, the annihilation of the Jewish people in the heart of the city, in which he tears his clothes and wears sackcloth and puts ashes on his head. That would have been recognized as a common practice and formal act of mourning, as it appears several other places in the Bible, the closest comparison probably being the Ninevites in Jonah 3 when they repent and ask God to spare them their impending destruction. Perhaps this is what Mordecai is doing as well. He's raising protest against the injustice they're experiencing. Mordecai walks from the city center to the palace gate in this mourning fashion, a gate at which he cannot enter. And again, the author draws our attention to the boundary between those within the palace and those without. The ones who raise complaint against those in charge are not even allowed to enter into where they may be heard. Inside the palace of power, grief is not allowed. There has been a clear line drawn between those with privilege and those without it. And it's at this point that Esther becomes the central character of the narrative. Mordecai has been doing his public mourning ritual, and she heard about it, so she tries to send him some fresh clothes. Her motivations here are a little bit unclear. Maybe she was embarrassed he was doing this, maybe she simply wanted him to be allowed entry into the palace, and maybe she was trying to comfort him. But after he refuses the clothes, we realize that Esther doesn't know about the edict because she asks why he's acting this way. So Mordecai sends her a copy of the edict through an intermediary, a eunuch named Hathach, to read. Hathach is able to cross the boundaries that neither Esther nor Mordecai are able to cross, between the palace and the rest of the kingdom. So they use him to communicate. Mordecai has already hatched a plan that he expects Esther will immediately agree to, because that has always been the case. He asks Esther to go before the king and simply ask that he spare the Jews from their destruction and reveal to him her Jewish identity, which she kept secret at the direction of Mordecai when she was chosen as queen. Perhaps then, with her supplication, he will concede and salvation will come to the Jews. The Jews will be saved. But Esther does something that Mordecai does not expect. She says no. She knows the rules of the Persian court and has acclimated. She's been queen for 5 years. And she knows if someone comes before the king without being summoned, doesn't matter who it is, then it is by Persian law that she should be immediately executed. Unless, of course, the king were to hold out his golden scepter to her, only then could she be saved. But the problem is he hasn't summoned Esther in 30 days. So she fears that she may have already fallen out of favor with him. So she decides the plan is far too risky and that she will not do it. This comes as a complete shock to Mordecai, but he does not let her say no so easily. He takes a more severe tone and reminds her that she isn't safe, for the very danger the Jews face emanates from the palace in which she sits at this very moment. She won't escape Haman's wrath as she thinks she might, because even if she decides to remain silent, says Mordecai, and help must come from another quarter, she will not survive it because Mordecai's family will be the first to go. By another quarter, Mordecai probably means another person who is willing to work toward God's purposes. Surprisingly, this is the closest the book ever gets to mentioning God, a realization which caused some problems during the canonization period, but all it really does is possibly imply that God is working in the world in the background, allowing humans to use their agency to work out the purposes of God. And Mordecai asks, who knows? Saying that no one knows whether Esther's ascent to the throne was divine providence in order to save the Jews, but if it was, and she does not act, she will be disobeying the unspoken plan of God. According to Mordecai, if Esther is forced to choose between Persian law and the Jewish people, her loyalty should lie with her people, for perhaps she has come to royal dignity for such a time as this. And this is the point for Esther at which unawareness and distance from the problem becomes awareness and dilemma. She finally understands the gravity of the problem, and a transformation occurs. She was introduced as an orphan girl, raised by her cousin Mordecai with nothing but a pretty face. She was passive and obedient to Mordecai, and she was a people pleaser. It was because of her passive nature that the king probably chose her, and it was the antithesis of Queen Vashti's opinionated and spirited nature. But Mordecai reminds her that silence is not a valid choice in this situation, and she accepts an active role and decides to take the risks. Except now, Esther refuses to be in the background, positioning herself as front and center. Now, she must reveal her Jewish identity at the possibility it could get her killed for the salvation of the Jewish people. The reader can now trust her as an authoritative royal figure, because she has taken charge and we know she's working for the betterment of the Jewish people. Even her own death no longer scares her. She's not going to do as Mordecai says, because now she's in charge. Now we see a true Queen Esther who rises to her position in royal dignity. She gives the orders to Mordecai, which he promptly follows. Her instructions are that the entire Jewish community in Susa is to come together to observe a 3-day fast, a fast that Esther and her maids, who probably aren't Jewish, will also participate in from within the palace, kind of a melding of boundaries in a way. After this fast, she will appear before the king, hoping he holds out the golden scepter to her. Even though she knows this could be her death, she is resolved and states, "If I perish, I perish." She is a woman in a male-dominated court and has no guarantee of success, but she has accepted whatever outcome she gets and has decided to put her people first. In the story that follows, we see that her plan works and Haman is hung on the gallows he built to execute Mordecai on, and the novella-type story is given a classic, ironic revenge ending that is satisfying to us as readers. But the moral of our story, the ending of our movie, is not that all the people were saved and lived happily ever after. Rather, this story is a little bit more like Moana. if you've seen that movie. A story in which the journey is more important than the destination. Esther's journey of transformation. And honestly, this is probably really familiar to a lot of us. This story revolves around a woman who must deal with a problem that she didn't create and doesn't want to be dealing with, but because of her position on the privileged side of the political and economic boundaries, she must. Our journeys of grief or growth often first begin in denial, in a resounding no, just as Esther's did. And sometimes we find ourselves in situations in our lives in which we are expected to act on the behalf of an oppressed person or an oppressed people. But we feel totally out of our depths and have no idea why it must be us. These situations also often create negative consequences for us, just as it did for Esther. She had to resolve to face her death if the king did not accept her risk. While the risks for us may not be nearly as absolute or maybe not as dire, they may be just as devastating to each one of us. Perhaps this means a job loss or a family rupture for you, or a countless number of other consequences that may be hard to overlook when discerning God's call. But the truth of the matter is that sometimes our spiritual journeys look a little bit different than we think they will. Especially in our day and time, with everything happening in our political, economic, and bodily health spheres, when we are put into a situation in which we need to be the advocate for the oppressed, we have to think to ourselves, what's my role here? Why is it my role? Am I on the privileged side of the boundary? Let me just close with an example. I can be certain that dealing with systemic racism is uncomfortable. Not a problem that I created myself, and it's most certainly a problem that will have negative consequences for me if I fix it. Even if only in that I will not benefit as much from the unjust systems in place. But I have a responsibility to be the advocate for the oppressed because of what side of the boundary I'm on. For me, I'm on the privileged side of the boundary in that I'm not categorically a part of the oppressed group because of my skin. Maybe yours is the economic advantages you have, your involvement in the PTA, or any of a million ways that you could be in a perfect position to start change. We're going through a transformation right now. Our churches are making changes. Our communities are making changes. We are making changes. And right now you might be at that point of the resounding no. And a great sense of denial may be overcoming you right now. And I get it because the world we live in right now is so scary. But perhaps God is in fact here in the background, in between and on both sides of the boundaries, allowing us to make the choice about our involvement in furthering God's purposes. For perhaps we were created for such a time as this. Amen.